And welcome back to the second half of our Inside podcast with CEO Noel O'Connor. Noel, we've had so many questions for you from across the organisation. We don't want to leave anybody out. So we're going to go to a question first from...
from Barry O'Sullivan. He had a couple of interesting questions, actually. The first was, the incoming European Commission President has stated that she will introduce a regulation on artificial intelligence in her first 100 days in office. What are your views on that, first of all? He wonders, is it the right thing to do? And are there any issues you think are particularly important for the regulation to cover?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Thanks, Barry. So I think we're all aware the speed at which AI is moving and progressing and changing aspects of our society and potentially changing them significantly. So I think regulation is to be welcomed as long as it's sensible and doesn't stifle creativity or technological progress, but balances that against the ethical and societal implications of the technology. I think the whole aspect of explainable AI is hugely important in that context. If we're going to be entrusting decisions to be made to machines, it's extremely important that we understand how those decisions are made and are able to justify and stand over those decisions and explain them to the people affected by those decisions. So I would welcome regulation. I think it's analogous to what happened with GDPR when it came in recently. There was a lot of talk about it, a lot of concern around it, a lot of mixed views on it. But I think with the benefit of hindsight, we can look back on it and say that it has really been beneficial initiative in our environment. It's really helped raise awareness of data privacy, data ethics, and it's really helped put manners on us as researchers, but also on industry. So I think GDPR was a huge success, quite honestly, and I think any regulations in this space as well have the potential to have a similar stabilising effect on what is a very, very fast moving field.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, I'm just going to inject the question of my own here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think philosophically about AI? Do you wonder about the bigger picture, its relation to humans, to human development, to where we're going as a society and the role of AI?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't but work in this field and not think about that. It's very easy to get blinded by the technological marvels that you could potentially accomplish by virtue of your research, but you also have to stop and think about the practical implications of this. I mean, the reality is something I struggle with, that, you know, if this is another industrial revolution, well, that's going to have a transformative effect on society and people's work and people's daily life. If we look back on previous industrial revolutions, you know, they have been significant seismic changes in society, and maybe we're about to establish or experience something similar now as well. And that will bring both pain with it, but also huge benefits to society. So it's difficult to influence that, I suppose, globally. The best we can do as a research centre is to be intimately aware of and sensitive to the implications of our work and think deeply about the research that we're doing and try to understand how it can have a beneficial effect on society as opposed to a detrimental effect.
Do you think that there really is the awareness, though? I mean, the things that are coming out now in terms of AI and even data sets that machines are trained on and that kind of thing, I mean, there is a huge amount of worrying information coming out about the fact that an awful lot of AI decisions and algorithms, they benefit people who the data sets are based on, which generally are men, they're white, English speaking, whatever it is. This is very, very dangerous stuff. Yeah.
Are
really
we encoding imbalances that are already there, but now we're locking them in?
Absolutely, yeah. Inherent biases and implicit biases that we may not even be aware of. And this is, I think,
actual biases that we may not be aware of, but actually exist. I mean, the idea that voice recognition works better for men than women, and often you will find a woman cannot get a Alexa or whatever to listen to her unless she lowers her voice, and that stuff is established. It's kind of extraordinary, but we're only beginning to cotton on to it, and it sometimes feels like the research is racing ahead and people, including politicians, are making decisions based on research and they are not aware of these issues.
Yeah, I think it goes back to Barry's question about regulation and why it's so important, right? Mm-hmm. I think the challenge with AI is because it's moving so fast. I mean, technology is very often ahead of regulation, and regulation is brought in to counterbalance that. But the speed of AI is frightening. quite honestly, and society is struggling to catch up. But, you know, we're lucky that we have, within Insight, we're lucky that we have voices in Europe like Barry contributing to those discussions and those narratives and informing the people who have to make those decisions. But I think it's a huge challenge for us to address that issue of bias in AI. At least we're aware of it now. Right. Mm-hmm. For a long time, we were just battering on with our research and developing our techniques. And sure, once we got good results on our academic data sets, we were happy out, and we weren't too concerned about the underlying implications of what the algorithm was doing. Mm-hmm. I think there's much better awareness, at least within the research community now, mm-hmm. and maybe that will engender a new, more ethically informed approach to AI, at least within the research community.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Kat Drew in Policy Lab in the UK spoke about the idea, particularly in relation to smart cities. Of making sure that the data sets you're working with are actually capturing everybody in the city and all different demographics in the city and also different socioeconomic groups and so forth. Mm-hmm. So again, the research itself is obviously, it's important that it's woke,
yeah.
but also the data you're working with.
Absolutely.
You may not have much choice over that.
Yeah. Well, it all comes back to the data. At the end of the day, you're only as good as your data, right?
Yeah.
When you say you may not have any control over that, well, then it behooves us to take control over that and start to generate our own data sets. If we believe there are existing data sets out there that are driving technology advances that aren't fit for purpose when you consider things like bias, for example, then why don't we step up and actually produce our own data sets that we believe better reflect the actual situation and, you know, not fall into the same traps that we've fallen into in the past.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to sort of switch direction here and bring you a question from Nuala Brilcon in Galway. Do you think that practical collaboration between the Insight centres across the country is important? Now, you have addressed that, but Neil does ask specifically what new initiatives you might bring to the table.
There's a couple of initiatives, I think. And we're trying to permeate this idea of cross-site collaboration across everything that we do. So in part one of the podcast, I mentioned the EPE call for proposals for citizen science. You know, a key aspect or a key requirement of that call was that proposals be cross-site, so that people had to speak to each other across the various different sites in order to be able to put a proposal together. And if the proposal is successful, then they have to work together to implement that that proposal. Above and beyond that, the entire research program is structured around a core of cross-site and cross-discipline collaboration. Very often in Insight, cross-site and cross-discipline means the same thing, because we have different disciplines located at the different sites. Not exclusively, but that's, you know, sometimes I use them interchangeably. The research program is designed around these research challenges, and we have two research challenge leads from two different sub-disciplines within that broad research challenge, and they have been asked and mandated to drive forward a core set of collaborative activities within that research challenge. Not that everything needs to be collaborative. It's where it makes sense, where it's mutually beneficial for all concerned, so it's not collaboration for collaboration's sake, but they are required to come back with a small number of key cross-site, cross-discipline collaborations. And then at the next level up, at the exec with the research challenge leadership will be looking at cross-research challenge opportunities for collaboration. And they will feed into our demonstrator and integration program, which is the shop window, if you like, for how we collaborate to the external world. So that notion and that ethos for collaboration, I think, is interwoven throughout the structure of the research program. And we as the exec are happy, where appropriate, to resource things like demonstrators, right, in order to get to kickstart that, because very often there's a cold start problem here. People might, you know, want to collaborate, but they need some additional resource to actually get that collaboration up and running. So if that's the case, by the way, we expect people to look for collaborations anyway with their existing allocation. But if it's the case that something needs an extra bit of resource or investment to really lead to impactful collaboration, please come and talk to the exec. We'd really like to hear from you. We'd really like to understand how we can help. Mm-hmm. And we're an unparalleled place to be able to do that at the moment, because we're at the start of Insight, where everything is not locked down. Okay. Right. I think the other important point to that question is how we're reconfiguring the business development team. right? So in Insight 1, we had business development people located at each site who primarily looked after that individual site. We're changing that in Insight 2 to have a more cohesive approach to business development, where individual people will be responsible for different industry sectors and represent Insight to the external world, irrespective of where that expertise is located, so that we will have people from the Dublin sites bringing projects to Galway and Cork, and vice versa. And all of that speaks to this holistic view of collaboration across the site, motivated by the fact that we have been told in no uncertain terms by Science Foundation Ireland that we need to act more cohesively. We need to be greater than the sum of our parts.
Putting the lens back on you, what would you like to be? Sorry, this is a question from Linda O'Sullivan in Cork. What would you like to be if you were not a professor of electronic engineering?
So many things. Let me think about that. If I was not a professor of electronic engineering, I would like to be... I'd like to be a science fiction writer, actually, is what I'd like to be. Yes, I would. I would be. Yeah.
Really?
That's my inner nerd coming out.
And who do you like to read in the science fiction field?
Everyone and anyone. I'm more a fan of the hard sci-fi, as it's called, and particularly British authors, but not exclusively. But the two staples I keep coming back to are Frank Herbert's Dune, which I think is a landmark in science fiction, then for the lighter side of science fiction, although it is aging a little bit now for the younger generation, Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I was asked a question about that in a table quiz the other night. I can't remember. Yeah. I was mad. That's very interesting. Mm. And have you a book in you?
I might have memoirs in me after Insight, the Insight role, but yeah, I have a few ideas, but maybe when I retire.
That's interesting.
Very interesting.
I think Matthew Duncan has a bit of a, creative.
We should start an Insight publishing house for fiction.
Exactly, a writer's group.
Yeah,
writer's
there
group.
You go.
Exactly. Fabulous.
You're again from Linda. What were your primary motivations for taking on the CEO role? I'm sure you had to give it a fair bit of thought.
Yeah, to ensure. I mean, to ensure that we built upon the momentum that we had established over the last 2 years. We started writing the proposal for Insight Phase 2 back in June 2017, right? When we all came together, we being the research leadership group across the centre, we co-designed a new research programme. We set out what we wanted Insight to be in the next phase of its evolution, and then we were subsequently reviewed. That was the trigger for the success of Insight Phase 2. And then we had our final Year 6 review, where we had to revisit those plans, make sure they still made sense, adjust them, tweak them if necessary. And all the while, we have been building momentum to catapult ourselves into the next phase. So it was really important, not just to me, but to the other site directors, to Brian, Barry and Matthew, that we didn't lose that momentum, right, and suddenly become in this kind of limbo state where we were waiting for something to happen. Mm-hmm. So stepping into the interim CEO role was motivated by ensuring that we build upon that momentum and that we successfully transition into Insight Phase 2, tusma, Latin Hebra, as they say, right? So it was really important that we had a good, strong start to Insight 2.
Great.
We might go back. There's one more sort of set, I guess, of more sort of serious questions, and then we've got a couple of a lot came in through this. but somebody asked about whether there's a structure in place for supporting experiments on multiple sites in Insight, like what the process would be for ethics application at a centre level, and what insurance would cover those sort of multi experiments.
I suppose it speaks to the unusual infrastructure.
Exactly, those sorts of practicalities and challenges that people face.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does reflect the fact that we are different to every other research centre. And I think what I would say here is that we have it within our gift to do this. I don't think there's been very many examples of this to date, but it's absolutely doable. We have done something similar with business development, whereby if there is a multi-site project, and we now have an increasing number of multi-site projects with an industry partner, one university takes the responsibility of that engagement of managing that project to contract phase on behalf of all of the other institutions. Why can we do that? Because we have an interinstitutional agreement which facilitates us to do things like that, which the various different institutions have signed up to, right? In the context of experiments like this, which might need ethical approval, for example, well, the typical approach would be that one site would typically be the lead partner on the research program, the piece of work that needs to be done. They might apply for ethical approval within their own host institution, and then upon approval, that approval would be accepted by the other institutions who wish to run the same experiment, and that again would be facilitated by our interinstitutional agreement. This has happened before, by the way, whereby we have projects with hospitals, for example, and ethical approval is only sought in one location and then accepted by the other institutions. So I think this is very easily accomplished and should absolutely not be a barrier to anybody who's interested in running this kind of research.
Okay, and that actually feeds into Barry O'Sullivan's second question. He was just asking about, how we can ensure consent is properly obtained and managed, with the advent of the GDPR and health regulations, and how Insight manages all of that, and what advice you would give to others working in this area. But I think you've possibly covered.
Well, I think I would say that we are very lucky in Insight, and I believe, by the way, that we're ahead of the curve in most compared to most research centres in this regard, because we have our own dedicated full-time intellectual property and data protection manager, Andreas Cullen, who works on behalf of the entire organisation to ensure that any time we are doing any research that involves any kind of personal data or sensitive data of any nature, that we are fully GDPR compliant, including informed consent at multiple different levels. And we have some really, really, really practical examples of how we've managed to, for example, take receipt of very sensitive data in a very ethical and a fully GDPR compliant way, and a fully secure way as well, I should say, right? So we actually have that resource within the centre that people should be availing of. Andreas does fantastic training as well, by the way, at all levels, for PhD students, for postdoctoral researchers, for PIs, and even has training courses that are specific to particular scientific disciplines, right? So he's a fantastic resource, and I would just encourage everyone to make as much use of Andreas as possible.
Great. Question from Professor Brian Caulfield in UCD. Recommendation for three songs that would be on Saturday evening or Sunday morning mixes.
Big difference between Saturday evening.
Yeah, there is.
I know. That was actually my first thought when I read the question, but hey.
Okay, okay.
Got to be true to material.
Okay. So let's do Sunday morning first.
Yeah. Okay.
So Sunday morning would probably be Velvet Underground. Some of the more mellower stuff, I would say. I've on a bit of a kick with the Decemberists at the moment, who I've recently rediscovered, so I'm playing a lot of their stuff. So that kind of mellow, chilled out vibe for a Sunday morning, on the rare occasions I actually get a lie-in, that's what I would be listening to. I'm not rushing out to training or gymnastics or something. Saturday night is kind of the same, because I don't go out anymore, to be honest. So yeah, maybe we just leave that one there.
Okay, and we actually had a question for you.
Okay.
You mentioned your young family. How do you manage to juggle work with home life and all that goes with it?
I think it's really important just to be aware of it. It is very easy to get lost in your academic life and career. I think it's a trap a lot of academics fall into, because it is so multifaceted, because we're doing so many different things very often at the same time, and there's so much context switching, and there's so many demands on our time. So it's really, really important just to be aware of that, and to, you know, to make the time for the family. And then one thing I try not to do at all is bring work home. So I very seldom these days open the laptop at home, even when people have gone to bed and there's no one else awake in the house. Just resist the urge to open the laptop and dive back into it, because then you're back into headspace. Mm-hmm. And something I find hugely beneficial is the kids' activities in the evenings, whether it be gymnastics, ballet, GAA, soccer, you know, getting out of the house and going with them to training and standing at the side, even if it's dark and cold and wet, is just great, great way of getting out of the headspace of being in work and, you know, refreshing yourself for the following day.
And what does your weekend look like?
A bit like a taxi driver's, I would say. So yeah, it's fairly full on with kids' activities, and they're all over the place. So yeah, driving around most of the day.
Yeah, although I used to do more of that than I do now, and I realised when it lessened with particularly with my older child, I realised that the car time is a very good time for talking about things. Mm-hmm. So you miss that, actually.
Yes, yeah.
You know, particularly maybe with boys, they don't necessarily want you to look them in the eye, but if they're beside you, you can cover more time.
Getting them to talk to you can be a challenge, though, sometimes when they're entering those sulky teenage years, right?
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm now.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite activity to do with kids? That comes from Linda, by the way.
A favourite activity to do with the kids? No.
Just go where they go,
really. I do, actually, I suppose. I love watching them play sport. I absolutely love watching them play sport. And that's really what I spend a huge amount of time at weekends doing, and during the week. And even at, you know, trying to carve out time during the week, if possible, to go to school games or school races. My daughter recently ran her first cross-country race recently for the school, and that was just fantastic. She was so excited just to even to be there, to be picked for the team and to run the race and to finish. That's a fantastic experience, just to be there to witness that, you know, and her excitement around it.
And who does the ironing in your house?
My wife Nicola does the ironing.
Good woman, Nicola. Put an end to that. I stopped you that years ago.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
Gotta be acknowledged. Do you have a favourite song or movie that your kids have introduced you to?
Or band, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
Favourite? I have an awful soft spot for Matilda, the musical. Yeah, so the various songs from that, because they were playing incessantly in our car for a while. In terms of a movie, they're kind of looking more at movies I might be interested in as well. But when they were younger, you'd very often find yourself going to the cinema, you know, for a movie you'd never heard of, thinking, oh, this is going to be dreadful. What have I let myself in for here? You know, and then being really, really pleasantly surprised. I suppose the best example of that would be the first Muppets movie, which I went to, and I really was there on sufferance. I absolutely loved it.
It's really good.
Yeah.
I don't understand. You actually probably understand this question more than me. From Mark Rowntree.
Always different, always the same. If Mark E. Smith had been a data scientist, what would what would Mark E. Smith predict for music in 2020? So for our listeners not familiar, that's Mark E. Smith from the band The Fall.
Anyway.
The legendary fall, the mighty fall. So it was John Peel who famously said, always different, always the same, because The Fall made a career out of doing the same thing effectively for many, many years, but slightly differently and with different lineups. That is not, can I just say, Mark Rowntree, yes, our modus operandus in insight. It's not always different, always the same, right? Particularly as we move into phase two. In terms of what data science would look like in 2020, it'd be you and me, Mark, on the bongos. And Mark Rowntree will understand that reference.
All right, fair enough. Okay.
Olivia McCrum in ECT was wondering how you like your eggs in the morning.
How do I like my eggs? I like my eggs scrambled. Yeah.
Solid. Good one. You can't go wrong.
You can't go wrong. With a little bit of cheese sprinkled in, maybe, right, towards the end. Yeah.
Very good. And finally, I guess, Brian again was asking you to provide a robust defence against Dublin being split into two teams for next year's championship.
I have absolutely no problem with Dublin being split into two teams for next year's championship. My biggest problem would be who I'd support in the final, the north side or the south side. Do you like that, Brian?
And on that note,
I think think we'll wrap it up.
I think we'll wrap it up. Thank you very much, folks. Thank you to everyone who contributed.